Okay, Ruz, how are you? Hi.
Very good.
Great,
very good,
buddy.
Thank you.
Great. Pleasure to have you on the show, buddy. Besides your busy schedule, we have like a 10-hour difference, which is, to my eyes, huge. So thank you once again for adjusting your schedule. And although we fairly met recently, I think we connected on many levels, one being your passion for education. And before I start the amazing subject on education, I want the audience to know what you do currently, what you've been up to, what are your passions. So if you can just give a brief overview, I would appreciate that.
Sure, absolutely. Thanks for having me in here. It's always a pleasure to be a part of your interesting podcast. So to give you a little bit of background for your, kind of listener, I do practice in private practice. I also teach at the University of Washington as an associate professor. I cover about 20% of my week work goes to the school. I teach both to the dental students and the ortho residents. I run the interdisciplinary clinic, which is kind of a legacy of our department, is where Dr. Kokich and Dr. Matthew and Frank Spears at some point was also working on that. And then as you highlighted, I think we met at the EAS meeting in Greece, and I think we started talking about all AI and treatment planning, and we could have gone for like hours and hours talking about those. So I'm excited to be in here and just, we can have some chat about all of these.
Great. Perfect. Thank you so much. So I want to start with my last question because it's really relevant now, and I don't want people to miss the opportunity. So talking about the EAS, the European Alliance Society, now I believe it's a first that European Alliance Society is organizing a satellite event, actually a forum, in another continent than Europe, which is really exciting. And since US is kind of also like a closed box, a bit of a mystery for us, really, because you guys get to try the toys firsthand before it reaches us. So all the goodies. And we are really curious about how things move ahead, before they even get to us. And also it's going to be interesting in that way. And I know that you are an ambassador of European Alliance Society for North America, if I'm not mistaken. So what would you say about the event? So I highly recommend everyone to come, by the way. I registered already, so don't be shy. Click that button and come to Seattle. But what would you like to say about the event?
Sure, absolutely. So I think, this idea of having an aligner society in US, at least for me, has been, kind of like in the back of my head for the last few years. And when you look at the activities in US, most of the aligner specific events are run by companies, which are great. I mean, you got Invisalign Summit, you got Sure Smile aligners, kind of events. And those are great, but they're, when you go to those events, even like the smaller size, like 50 people, 30 people, 20 people, they're primarily around the features of one specific aligner system. So I personally always believe that we need to have a society where we can have all the aligner system. And, the days that we just had one aligner system is kind of gone, good for our patient and good for us. So you get a lot of choices. And you can also learn through learning different systems to collectively elevate the knowledge of aligner orthodontics. So, having this idea back in my head, I was like, okay, so I can either start a society. And then I, kind of like in parallel, I started looking into, right before COVID, is like, where can I learn more? And then I happened to came across EAS and, started going to the meeting, started talking to people. And just like, I found that as a great community in Europe, obviously, with, the vision that I always had in my head, a vision where you're a little bit agnostic about the aligner system that you work, you try to bring everybody on the table, and you also focus on research, education, evidence base. So then, as I got close to the kind of founder or the main people that run the society, they offered me to run the U.S. specifically U.S. ambassador position, because Dr. Sandy Tai covers the Canada. So both of us are covering North America. And then, going through these events, talking with them, and I'm like, okay, I want to start something, doing something in U.S. So instead of doing that, I was like, okay, what if we just expand this, and ultimately we can have people from U.S. to come to Europe, and the European can come to U.S. and just kind of mix this whole barrier that you mentioned, right? I think, when I talk to the people in Europe, as you said, U.S. maybe is a box, because we treat patients a little bit different. The expectation of a patient is different. The culture is different. Like, there are so many differences between, Europe in general, even Asia or U.S., even in U.S. between Canada, Mexico, and all those things will varies. But I feel like we all have a lot to share that helps all of us to grow, right? So, that was the main incentive behind starting the initiative. So we called it the EAS North America Aligner Forum. The first one will be in Seattle, because I'm in Seattle, so it helps us to do the events. I mean, obviously, there have been so many challenges. Like anything else, when you started, you kind of like, just like take the leap of faith and try to have everything to work. We are lucky that we got an amazing group of speakers, kind of all agreed to attend. We structured the meeting in a way that the first day is going to be all about industry, innovation, technology. We'll have a workshop on the first day. And the second day, we focus primarily on the science part, where in the beginning of the day, we have a lot of great speakers that talk about the science around the aligner orthodontics. And then in the afternoon, we will have three very interesting structure that I kind of learned that over the course of, attending that EAS meeting in Europe. We have a point counterpoint where we actually talk about, aligner orthodontics versus custom fix appliances. And to me, that's always such a great topic to discuss. There's no right or wrong way. I mean, the patients are different. Some wants, one version, some wants the other one. Plastic versus a wire, I think, is always an interesting topic. We also have a panel discussion about 3D printing. So I somehow managed to, be lucky to know a lot of people in different companies that are working in that field. So they're all agreed to come and attend. We'll have a panel discussion on that. And then we finish with a kind of like the last few talks on the business aspects of aligner orthodontics, because I feel like when you use aligners, you might want to adjust the way that you use that in your practice, that, it can improve efficiency, it can improve the, business aspects of it. So that would be the last kind of, plan. And hopefully we can extend this more into other countries. Even in US, we can repeat that, in a few years. But it's challenging because there's so many events, and so people having hard time to pick one versus the other. But you just do it and start and hope that people come in and like it and enjoy it and you repeat it.
Sounds excellent. I mean, I cannot wait really to be there. And thank you once again for organizing it. I know it's really difficult to organize events in this day and age. Also, to market them is a pain, but nevertheless, right. The concept is great. And as I said, yeah. And as you said, very eloquently, there is a barrier, and let's see what the guys over the pond are doing. So also the guys in US, I'm going to sure we'll see a lot of things from Europe that they can take away. So it's a great opportunity. Don't miss it, guys. Just register now, and let's meet in Seattle at the end of August.
Sure.
So moving on, going out, let's follow the education bits. So since we started on that, I want to talk about ongoing education, since you're also at the university, and it's your day-to-day job also to do ongoing education, right? But why do you think it's essential and necessary for the guys who are out of the university, maybe like 20 years now, to keep on going with the education events. The reason I'm saying this is in the ortho community, I believe people are a bit tightly sticking to ongoing education rather than the rest of general dentistry. That's what I see, at least. I mean, not statistically, but maybe the feel that I get. But maybe with younger orthos, I see this a bit changing with the new generation that's out there. Maybe that's that plays a part in this question, and also the rest of GPs, right? So why do you think it's essential to move on with ongoing education?
Yeah, I think that's such a great question. You know, when you think about it, it's like, I'm going to talk in general, like orthodontics or even dentistry. I think the continuing education or CE is such a great opportunity for you to, you know, kind of enhance your clinical skills, you know, kind of think about how things are operating in your practice from the business perspective of it. And also just like professional development. If you don't go to DCs, if you don't keep your mind, you know, kind of sharp and hear other people and question what you're doing, I think at some point it's going to plateau and it's going to become boring. I mean, there are people that they really like that repeated, you know, kind of activities that are like, okay, my practice is running perfect. I don't need to change anything. You know, I turn on the light, everything works perfect. Why do I need to change it? I think that's definitely a way of approaching life. And there are people that are extremely successful in that. I personally think that, you know, I want to have change. I want to get, you know, kind of challenged my thought process. And the other thing is that, like, the days of having one aligner system, one bracket system, it has changed so much. And you get, like, the, you know, kind of virtual care mixed into the whole thing. You have multiple aligner systems. So you need to go to these events to try to learn how these things works and try to, like, kind of get some sort of a, you know, collective ideas and thought about it to change your principles, to change the way that you operate, right? You know, how do you do this? It's a huge discussion. People have different opinion about it. Some people like to go to the courses. Somebody likes to listen to podcasts. Somebody likes to read a book or the journal. But I think the presence of continuing education, it always going to help you. And, you know, I do have a local study club as a part of Seattle Study Club for general dentists and other specialties. So I kind of get to talk to them. Some of them I see that, like, they come out of the school, they buy a practice, they just kind of drop everything and they grow their practice. And then they come back in like 5-6 years later, they're like, okay, my practice is running pretty good. I'm just bored. I want to learn more. I want to know, what do I want to do next? So I think it's going to be there no matter what you think about it. The priority might go down or up based on the stage, based on the life of your practice or life of your career path. But I think the importance of it, I don't think that anybody would question that, because you just learn something in, you know, especially if you're a dentist, you get very minimum amount of training on orthodontics, at least in my university where I teach the dental student. We actually have a strong curriculum on the orthodontics, but for other university, I know some of them, they don't even cover it. So you come out, you try to learn more, you try to, like, go more, and specialists in a different way, right? So I don't think that it's just pure GPs or specialists.
Okay, great. Yeah, and tied to that, so we see, like, technological leaps every maybe 10 years, 20 years. In the ortho world, it's kind of a painstaking process. I know the leaps come in maybe a bit late in the process, but I mean, aligners were introduced in 2000s. Then the scanners are not very new, but the in terms of applicability and usability in the clinic, they have now evolved to that stage to be really efficient in the clinic, right? So it's another leap in the digital age. So that also bears a lot of load on a lot of doctors to learn those things, right? Because the majority that's out there is not educated on digital stuff. And it's a completely different world now. And moving at relatively fast paced, because even if you get those big leaps every decade or something, there are so many things along the way that you need to, you know, stick on board. Otherwise, if you go like every 5 years, every 10 years to an event, you'll fall so much behind. I mean, it's really difficult to catch up, right? So, but as you said, also, there is an event fatigue. That's out there. That's obvious. And how do you think people need to really pick and choose which event will be useful for them? I don't think it's easy, though. It's a question that I ask almost to my every guest, because this is a challenge, because you leave the practice when you attend these courses or events, which kind of diminishes the whole point of being at practice, making money stuff. You really need to pick and choose also, so that you don't get tired of these events too, right? Because you go to these things, some turn out to be not so great, and maybe you know some of that stuff when you go and see, you think that I'm here for nothing. So how do you think it needs to be structured, the events, in terms of communication maybe, and also how should people pick and choose these events?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. The way that I look at it, I actually look at it a little differently, right? So it's a very interesting term that I learned from a good friend of mine, that she's actually, you know, has a bunch of podcasts and products and stuff, called gross in reverse. So the way that I look at it, you know, as I mentioned, like, you got to figure out, where are you in your journey, right? Are you in the early stages of your journey, which you're trying to learn a lot of things, you're trying to set up a system? Are you right in the middle? Are you at the end, right? So then you figure out where you are. And then, as you said, you want to figure out, how much do you want to catch up with the technology? Mm-hmm. Or how much do you want to catch up with what is the current state of product X, method X, whatever it is, right? So you write these things down, so then you have a blueprint of what would be your approach to grow in whatever direction, for whatever magnitude that you want to go, right? Then at that point, then you can look into the events, right? So for example, I mean, in early days when I started, I had to start a practice, start from scratch. In early days, I didn't have a lot of luxuries of going to different places, because I just couldn't. As you said, I had to stay in, I had like one staff run everything. So I gravitated more toward communities online, where I can be engaged with them all the time, ask my questions, and then kind of go from there. Fast forward 5-6 years, when I have a very established practice, then I have the luxury of, okay, let's set up a week where my team is going to run the clinic, you know, for whatever that we need. I can bring an associate doctor to help me. Mm-hmm. Then I can go for a week for the course, right? So I think there is no one straight answer, right? It truly depends on, I would encourage anybody that who is thinking about it to start, you know, kind of backward. Think about where you are, what do you want to learn, and then pick the things that matches your lifestyle. If you want to take one vacation every year and you want to go outside of, you, for example, US, or you want to be in Europe, you want to come out of Europe, go to AAO or come to EAS if you're in US. So I think that's how I look at it. When it comes to the quality of these things, that's a different story, right? I honestly, that nobody, I mean, you could talk to your friend, you can look at the stuff. There's a lot of fear of missing out. There's so much marketing and things around it. There's no way that you can find if a quality of an event is good or bad. What I over time learned, you know, besides the main events where like AAO has, I actually like smaller meetings. To me, meetings that are like 50, 70, 80, 100 people attending, I generally found those so much more engaging. Because to me, part of also those meetings where I learn is actually one-to-one interaction with people. I think those are where you just talk to people and you will be amazed of like these systems that they have in their practices or the things that they're using. I was like, okay, this is such an amazing idea. And then one other items that I kind of started practicing is that if I do an event online or if I do an event in person, I build in the back of that event some sort of a day or 2 days to process it. Because if you don't process those information with a specific deadline of, okay, so I learned this, I'm going to spend 15 days to do A, and then B, and then C, and then drop it. And, you know, something that I actually learned from Dustin Burleson, he set up a time 45 days or 90 days after the event where he actually revisit what he learned, and he tried to remember what was those information, what were the information that he got, and what was the plan that he had to implement it or not implement it. So I think that's also very important. Like, you know, if you're going there to try to learn, make sure you immediately process it. Because if you go to an event, and I used to do these things, trust me, I learned a lot from my mistakes. You come in on, you stay till like Sunday, Monday you start your work, and you never get a chance to process that information. Then you just whoop it. Slowly you get into the grind of the week and the day, and then just completely forget about it. So having some buffer after the event, whatever it is, online, offline, in person, to process that information, and then having like a month, 2 months, 3 months after that, that's also very important.
So do your homework, basically. Huh?
Exactly.
So I like really how you put it, because you started with know yourself, right? Know where you are. And this is something that I see quite common, because I used to sell aligners. I'm providing education on aligners now. I do one-on-one treatment planning. So what I see usually with the beginners maybe more common in the beginners even, they want to right away see extraction cases, for example, with aligners. So people think that if they see the extreme, first they believe it, and then they think that they can build a bridge between the starting level and that extraction case right away, because they already have the ortho background. That's the common mistake that I see people do. So, I mean, thank you. That was a great way of putting it. And related to also what you said, companies provide a lot of events, right? So I believe that they have the best of intentions when doing this. Other than trying to sell their product, they know right now that without education on these products, doctor is going to be like a crazy person behind the wheel, right? So they need to get a hold of that system, know everything about it, because it's not a autopilot version of braces. So in that sense, what I see, what you said is also very interesting, the fear of missing out. That also relates to a lot of company events, because when companies organize events, people are like, they immediately feel the pressure that I should be attending these events. There's nothing wrong with that. But the thing is, I see also, since they get tired of attending events after the company events, I feel that for the other events, they don't have any room in their heads, to fill with information, which I see a bit troubling, really. Even though the companies have the best of intentions, it's really, in the end, a biased information set. So what would you advise people in that sense when they're listening to company-owned educations? What should they look out for? What are the red flags, and how they should compare what they hear and learn in those events, the company events, to the real world? How they should relate that to the real world?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I believe that the presence of industry in our field is just inevitable. I mean, we're using their stuff, so they're going to have to try to educate you to sell more. And that's a good thing. Actually, it doesn't have to be any bad thing. And I have been a part of the speakers that went up and talked for a company. So I've seen both end of it, right? I mean, absolutely, there are some of them that are just like really low quality, and there are some that are really high quality. And that's just something that you just have to try it and see which one is good, which one is bad. The way that I look at it also sometimes, some of the speakers, they truly believe what they're saying, right? The intention is not to try to mislead people, but sometimes there's lack of or gap in their knowledge, or they don't really understand the things. Maybe they get so much influenced by the marketing, you know, message that they just believe in it. And sometimes you just, the easiest way is like, okay, I do it in the clinic, I see the result, and I believe that this is the way that it works. And here is the cases that I show that it actually works. So, you know, I think the way that I look at it, and I go to every events that I can, and I found that interesting, and it's in the cycle where I actually need the information on the topic that I'm interested in. And the way that I look at it, I go in and I write down all the things that I'm learning from them, right? And consider every ideas, every point, every things that they're telling you as a hypothesis, right? It's not always right or wrong. If I am coming to you and say that, okay, I have this product, it has three different plastic and is going to move the teeth better, use it for complex cases, A, B, and C, try to truly understand what that product is, right? And then consider that, okay, maybe this is right, maybe this is not right, and test it, right? And try to like kind of put it in the perspective, in the context of all the other information that you have to see if it makes sense or not, right? And honestly, like, even if it doesn't make sense, even if it's something that is like, okay, completely off, then you walk away. You learn it, right? The only way that you can do it by, you know, kind of engaging more in activities, getting more information, processing it, and just don't take it as like, you know, the hardcore principle fundamentals of things that is going to go. That's how I look at it, right? I mean, again, there are companies that they set up really, really good CEs. Some that are like average, some that are not good. But, you know, I think going in with an open eye, with no judgment, and then having a thought process of, okay, what I'm learning, what I'm hearing from these speakers, they might be right, might be wrong, mm-hmm. and I'm just going to test it. And then be super critical about it, right? Just not buy any ideas, you know, at the face value and go from it. And interestingly, when I go and try to do these events for some of the companies that I work with them, the first thing that I tell the people is like, this is my opinion. This is what I can tell you from what I learned. And I encourage you to question everything that I'm saying, because I want you to go and test it and think through it. And if logically it doesn't make sense, then don't do it. And then there are gaps in, like, one of the very interesting topics, especially when it comes to aligners, there's a huge gap in the knowledge around plastic. I mean, I can tell you, I got lucky because I started working with Bay Materials, because I work with the chemists that they develop it, and I learned over time, and I read so many books and articles that are even not related to orthodontics. And the more that I learn about it, the more that I see how much we actually don't know about plastic, which it has changed a ton from the days that, you know, we had no clue. I think part of it, we're kind of thankful to in-office aligners, mm-hmm. because when we started making this stuff, then we get more conscious about, okay, so what is a good plastic? How do I have to do it? What are the differences? When I have 10 options, how do I choose? So that increase significantly enhanced our overall knowledge about plastic. But still, that's one of the domains that not a lot of people know about it, right? I mean, you get marketing agendas from various companies put in front of you. And if you don't know it, you just don't question it. You just go with it. And everybody tells you that they have the best plastic in the world.
Exactly. And also the best system, the best planning software. And that's another story, by the way.
Sure.
Thank you. So, yeah, I want to also expand on this question from the faculty perspective. So you have aligners on curriculum, right? You teach aligners at the university. So what do you see that, I mean, maybe it will be biased what your answer will be, but relating to real-life patients and real-life applicability, How would you rate the education in not only your university, but in general, to the best of your knowledge, to be able to, the education provided in those universities on aligners, how does it relate to real life? So, sure. I mean, go ahead.
I think in our department, the way that we operate, we don't have a very specific aligner course. We have it dispersed across the education because the way at least that our program in the last, you know, over 75 years was structured, we teach fundamentals. We're not really heavy on technique. We're heavy on evidence. And then we have a lot of faculty in the way that is a structured, the clinic, the faculties, they teach a lot of the technique. So I think ultimately, I believe that all the schools and universities would have some, you know, more robust aligner structure or curriculum. We're not there. I don't think that there's a lot of schools that they have it. And those that they have it, you know, they just probably try to fit it in there. And it all depends on how the education is structured in every program. I think at the end of the day, the way that I look at it in the education part, you just go through these phases, right? So in the beginning of your training, you have no idea. When you get in the middle of it, you just kind of thinks that you know it all. Then you start doing and you start to like completing the cases. You're like, oh, I have no idea. And then you get out and then there's 5-6 years after that. So I think that what I encourage all the students, at least my resident, I always tell them that try to learn the principles, because if you understand the principles, you can always build protocol, technique, and stuff around it, right? I think part of it is also practice. Like, you just have to see certain number of the patient. And as you mentioned, I think it makes all the sense to not start with crazies, right? Mm-hmm. So, like, treat the cases that are a little easier, kind of get a feel of it, of the aligners, get a feel of what works, what doesn't work. And at least for myself, I feel like I started looking at everyone and every person that you can possibly get a lecture out my hand to it. I would listen to it and watch it. And just because it helps me to like think through my ideas, like the way that I treat cases, it's my way, which is, you know, an amalgamation, a combination of so many different people, what I learned from, and also my personal thought and the way that I think about biomechanics and all of those. Right or wrong, I get the patient to the end, right? And this is the other things about aligners. There's a lot of opinion out there of how things works.
Exactly.
And some of them are actually proven scientifically incorrect, but people are still doing it, right? I can give you a great example. I mean, I did my research on OpenBite. My department is very kind of famous on doing a lot of studies through OpenBite because my chair, Dr. Wong, he has done a lot of work on it. We have done enough research along with other people showing that to close an open bite with aligners, you get a really good success, you know, somewhere in the ballpark of 100%. So aligners are great appliances for open bite. But what we learn from the mechanics, the biomechanics that you're going to make this happen is going to be primarily by extruding the anterior teeth. There's a lot of protocol out there that they say that you intrude nothing. To this day, multiple research shows that you actually can intrude the posterior teeth. But people are still believing it. They do a show and tell. And, you know, it's fine. I mean, to me, honestly, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. Because the success is for the patient. The teeth will work. And you build all these, you know, kind of strategies and smart technique that at the end of the day, they don't really do anything. Maybe they help with the extrusion of the anterior teeth. But that's where we are. This applies to so many different things.
Yeah, you are a very open-minded academic, by the way, I should tell you, because not everyone thinks like that. I mean, that's also troubling. The research on aligners, it's a tricky business, you know, because you have a lot of research out there, which I wouldn't even spend time reading, because and people reference those research in their like speeches, lectures, whatever. I mean, there's too many variables when it comes to doing these research, because is the patient wearing the aligners? Who's planning the cases? Who's bonding the attachments in what way, using which composite, whatever. I mean, so many variables. And did the attachments break? Did they wear out? So, I mean, million things that could have happened along the way. So you need a sample size so large, I don't think it's possible to do a really like healthy research on many of the things. But that's, again, like the education bit. So which are you going to believe, right? Which is going to make sense to you, obviously. But again, it comes back to your practice. So you need to test those things in your practice, not maybe blindly, but, you know, one step at a time. So, that's really something to, again, maybe look out for. But regarding research, so I'm sure you do a lot at the university. What would you suggest people who are going to do research on aligners in terms of, trying to give the right information, not just having their names on papers and stuff, but really, truly helping the world of aligners? Do you have like a brief strategy in mind looking at research?
I mean, the research is a very complicated topic, right? Mm. And especially when it comes to orthodontics, I mean, collecting the sample is always hard. I can give you an example that one of my students who is working on the stability of the transverse dimension post-surgery with aligner versus fixed appliances, we started looking at the records. We started with like 600 cases, 700 cases. After looking at all of those of patients, that we needed complete set of records. We're on 22, from like 600 to 22. So it's extremely hard to get the complete picture because patient moves, practices, they don't take the record, things get fall off the track. So it's not always easy to do the research. I think sometimes I feel like people have ideas and they want to prove it right or wrong. And I think it should be the other way around. Mm. You ask a research questions, you know, is this doing X, Y, and Z? Is this not doing X, Y, and Z? And test that, right? I think you and I talk a little bit about that AI ideas. And I would love to, at some point, one of my students work on that with you on that project. There's so much research out there, right? Some of those authors, they have agenda. And I say this as it is. So you got to be careful with it. And even like, for example, I have a paper that I published and I think it was great at the time, but there are a lot of things about it that I personally believe that it has changed because the technology has changed. Sure. Because orthodont has learned how to plan things. I mean, we learn so much about the biomechanics. So I think it's good to not be biased about the research, but also open to, like, I think the extreme in both end is not good. I mean, I hear the people are like, all people cite whatever paper that they want and they say what they want. That's a very true statement. But like, when you get into the deep of evidence, then you need to have meta-analysis with a structure, with a very stringent technique. Like if you see a behavior happens in multiple paper that are done correctly, their methodology is done correctly, then maybe that's the truth, right? You might not like it. I had a discussion with one of my buddies who's a really good oral surgeon. And he's like, there's a good stat and data that if you take out wisdom teeth, you're putting the patient at the risk of TMJ. It ranges from 10 to 30%, depending on the report that is out there. And he was not happy with him when I told him. He was like, all the oral surgeons are creating TMD. I was like, maybe they do, maybe they don't. You don't know that, right? Yeah. And so you look at the body of the literature. You don't pick one article and say that, okay, this one article says this, so it's going to be this way. Like, I mean, we moved in research so far from like 1950s when you do a show and tell paper to like all these systematic review. And then, you know, there are issues with research. Nothing is perfect, right? Clinic is not perfect. Science is not perfect, right? So you just have to be unbiased and truly look for the truth and use those information with their limitation to try to answer it. right? So that's how I look at it.
Yeah, I mean, like the lectures, right? There are a lot of contradictions. Everyone has an opinion in the lectures, or research, I think, follows that. Everyone has an opinion that they want to prove, and they prove it somehow, right? So again, it's filtered, of course, but still, there are ways to get there if you want to prove something that you believe in. That's kind of getting in the way of making aligners a positive science, right? Because everyone says something different, and you see that what they say also works in the mouth. So you don't know what to pick and choose, like we discussed. So that's something I think that we're going to have to battle with the rest of our lives, professional lives at least. So it's always trial and error. So it's both exciting and also frightening at the same time, I believe. But there are a lot of opportunities. So I want to also discuss these opportunities that are out there with you. But I want to start with in-office aligners. So I know you do them. When in-office aligners first came out, we all thought that, I mean, at least some of my friends and I thought that this is going to be the future of aligners. I mean, it's not going to be just stuck with companies. People are going to take this, like Apple was built in a garage, right? I sort of relate to that idea with in-office aligners. So there are going to be a lot of innovative stuff out there. But I felt like up until recently, in-office aligners a little bit fell behind in that maybe quest or whatever you want to call it. But how do you position in-office aligners with the rest of the stuff that you do clinically?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. I have about an hour lecture on this, and I'm going to try to like summarize it very quickly. I think I actually called that lecture what I learned in the last 10 years about in-office aligners, yeah. Right? As you said, one of the biggest lessons that we take from that is that it's not going to replace the mass-produced aligners, right? It also, I believe that it has its own spot, and I'll explain to you where I would place it. I think there are a few great things happens through the in-office aligners. One of them, the era of like excitement around it, one of them was the knowledge around plastic. So that was huge. The other thing is that you can treat any case with in-office aligners. If you know what you're doing and if you're building a right system, there's no differences. It's just a different car, right? And I can go over it case after case after case that I treated, right? So like, you know, when I started my practice, because it was a startup, I purely just used in-office aligners, and I use it up to almost last year. And I can, the way that my system is designed, I have all sort of technology behind it, and we optimize it so we can make it happen all day, every day. We have a laser cutter, we, you know, have spin ray printer and all of those, and I use ULAB, and I build the software with the company, so I know exactly how it works. And to be honest with you, I like my aligners better than any aligners out there. But then the biggest caveat that you kind of tap on it is that, you know, at some point you become a lab. As you see more patients, then it becomes another kind of component of your whole operating system in your practice. If you have the bandwidth for it, I think it's a great solution to have it. I think you can double down on it. You can hire 2-3 people and run it, full-fledged operation. You will lose money on certain cases because the financial is a huge factor. So to me, I turn it into a supplement. As opposed to like covering all the aligners, I use it for specific cases. Anything that is a relapse directly goes to my aligners. I finish some of my aligner cases with my in-office aligners because it's just faster for me to get it going. Sure. I finish a lot of, you know, fixed appliances with aligners. I do for phase one, I use it a lot. So I kind of created this balance of like, you know, where is financially and human capital wise makes sense to use it. We used to buy like, you know, 20,000 sheets of plastic every month. Now we're down to like, you know, somewhere in the range of 2,000 to 3,000. We're still like, I have a full-time lab that works round the clock to run it, but I outsource it more. So I think that it's very important when it comes in other countries, like certain countries that you don't even have access to the aligners, the mass-produced aligners, or you, it's very, very expensive. That could even become more, you know, interesting or lucrative, or even, you know, more feasible to do it because you can also build. So the in-office aligners can be built with so many different tiers and strategies and, you know, materials and cost and all of those. So like in countries, for example, I'm originally from Iran. I think in Iran, you probably don't have access to those. So it makes sense to do in office. You can use cheaper printers. You can buy cheaper plastic. There are plastic that are never going to be sold in US because they're infringing on patent of some other companies.
Yes.
But you can buy those plastics and use it, and you can really reduce the cost. And I can tell you some of those plastics are probably as good as the plastic that we use in here. So I think it's not going to go anywhere. I can guarantee you that in-office aligner is going to be part of all ortho practices. Some practices opt to use it. Some practices just completely eliminate it. And it also sits next to your retainer program. If you have a lab, if you're making a retainer, then it makes sense to have some degree of in-office aligners. And it could be like as large, as small as you can think that you wanted to have it.
I think also commercially, having maybe starting a standalone in-office aligner business is kind of difficult because it's like a chicken and egg
Very
situation.
hard.
Yeah, so you need the volume to support that investment, right? But you don't have that, so it's kind of difficult in that sense. But I also truly believe, I don't know if you agree, please tell me, but to start learning aligners, if you try to do it with in-office aligners, I think it's going to be an immense task to learn about aligners through the in-office aligners, learning curve. Because you have many things that you need to take care of, right? But you, I mean, it's more comfortable to learn about the biomechanics, the ins and outs with like mass-produced aligners than if you're like also an innovative guy who needs to go through that pain of having all the technology in the clinic, right? And so both financially and also mentally. So if you're into that, I think it's a great solution. But what do you think about the 3D printed aligners that are coming out?
That's a very sensitive topic. I think that's something that I've been working on it because 3D printing is always very exciting to me. I feel like we've improved a lot from where it used to be, let's say 4 or 5 years ago. Even the quality of these aligners looks so much better. The software programs are getting so much better. They're getting more like a one click, two click, as opposed to like a very tedious process. And then, you know, I do use them in the clinic primarily for research purposes and like very simple tests and stuff. I think there are a few major issues with that. The biggest one that we learned from in-office aligners, nobody wants to do all of it. So doing that in office is going to open another can of worm. The fabrication process is actually not as easy as people think that you're just going to click it. It requires different type of complexity. There are a few fundamental questions that we have that we're trying to answer it. The biggest one is the staining of these aligners. They stain generally heavily. And then the solution that the companies they have, they're great, but they're adding another layer of complexity to the patient day-to-day life. I don't really like it. I believe that when we truly believe that this is 10x, 5x, 2x, 3x better than plastic, then I can ask my patient, I was like, oh, by the way, put it in these things and clean it. But if I know that it's not, even if it's equal one to one, why am I adding this to my patient? So I personally don't like it to add more stuff to my patient's day-to-day work. I try to simplify things for the patient so they can succeed in the treatment. And the other factor is about the level of the forces. I think that's a huge debate. Again, there's a lot of improvement in it, but it's still not there. I mean, and I've tried to move simple movement and stuff. It's not as efficient as plastic, so I'm still primarily on plastic, but very optimistic about 3D printing stuff. They're very exciting. I mean, there's so many cool stuff you can do. Yeah,
and they have the potential to also change everything we know fundamentally about the aligners, right? The behavior of the plastic is going to be completely different once we have efficient working 3D aligner system. So for coming to the last part of the podcast, I want to talk about AI a little bit. And then I'm going to have one last question for you. But you are an innovative guy. Use technology. You are a friend of technology, let's say it like that, both professionally and in your personal life, I believe. So how do you use AI right now? I mean, not only from an ortho perspective with the ortho glasses, but also in your day-to-day life.
Sure. That's a great question. So I always kind of joke about it and not joke about it. I have two assistants that I pay them $25 a month, and they work 24/7. One of them is ChatGPT, the other one is the Claude. I really use AI mostly on organizing big tasks. Like if I have a project that I need to look at it. The other way that I use it, it's just like forcing to question myself, right? So let's say that I write a piece or I have an idea in my head and I'm like, okay, look at this idea, look at this thing that I think and look at it from X, Y, and Z lens and tell me what am I getting wrong or where can I be more kind of innovative about it or where can I expand on it? So it truly like an assistant and if a cheap assistant that can be available to you whenever you want. Sometimes I'm driving in the car and I'm like kind of having an argument with ChatGPT about silly things. Or like as simple as we had a backyard project in my house and I took a photo and I just like feed it to ChatGPT. I was like, I want to flatten this piece. What are the equipment that I want? Is it something that I should do it or I should outsource it? You can have fun with it, right? Yeah, sure. It doesn't need to be always like orthodontic stuff. So that's the primary things that I do. I do a lot of like deep research stuff and I've been so tempted to switch to the actual premium version of the ChatGPT because I feel like at some days it just tap my query and it drives me crazy because I'm like, I want to keep going with that. So I really like the project and I have a few projects that are just constantly going on and I just like feed into it and ask it. So I think it's something that I encourage my student to do it. I'm actually setting up a session for them to show them what I do so they can learn it. I think it's naive to just not use it at this point with all these, you know, improvement stuff. And it's just, it doesn't need to be anything complicated, right? It could be just as simple as just like helping you to be better, helping you to do things better, helping you to see the things that you would miss it. That's how I look at it. And I use it almost every day, all day.
No, I mean, the way we interact with the world is completely different now with AI. The way we search for information, the way we ask questions, because writing the prompts are also something to learn. There is a learning curve. Sure. I believe that prompt engineering is going to be like the thing of the future.
100%.
Yeah, so in that way, I believe right now there is a great divergence among the general society, people who use AI and people who don't use AI. And it's going to be a lot more severe in the future, I believe. So people who have access also to AI and people who don't. And there is so much room for advancement when you use it. Save so much time. I mean, I cannot really go back right now to the days that we didn't have AI, honestly.
Correct, yeah.
That's also something that I ask aligner providers because they sometimes complain about aligners, some companies sometimes, the way that they treat them and stuff. I tell them, what if I took aligners away from your practice? You know, what do you do then? They would say I would probably diminish and die. But anyways, So AI is in that sense really changed our lives, I believe. But from a professional perspective then, so how do you implement AI right now on the ortho business?
Yeah, for the ortho stuff, some of the project that I have for my practice, I run it through that. Like I'm working on a manual for all my team, and I use that to kind of structure things or like, again, question all the things that I write. The biggest project that I have on AI, I joined a company called OrthoBerry almost a few months ago, 6-7 months ago. And we are building a patient management software, not necessarily a practice management software. Mm-hmm. And the backbone of it is going to be driven by AI. We had to start a lot of this stuff from scratch. Mm-hmm. To build the framework to be able to add the AI, right? So that's
sure.
That's kind of like a larger, you know, more ambitious, you know, plan that we have. And it's going pretty good. I mean, we're fairly new, young company, just turned a year, with good group of very smart, young, talented engineers. So we are working on that as like a bigger, larger project. Mm-hmm. The other thing that I do, I encourage my team to use it. So mm-hmm. they use the Microsoft Copilot mm-hmm. or the Google Gemini, because we have a workspace, which is a HIPAA compliant, especially for like writing notes or sending emails. I encourage them, like, you know, process your thought, mm-hmm. just do a little bit better than just the usual things that you send with mm-hmm. some errors and issue with it. So it different layers in different things, basically. That's what we are.
I mean, it does the rudimentary stuff perfectly. So with cognitive things, you need to do some supervision. But with rudimentary things, it's perfect. So true. Going back to the patient management thing that you talked about, your company that you're involved with. So is it also like helping the practice to grow or...
So we are basically starting with the first part of these project is actually through intake, patient intake forms, mm-hmm. right? So the way that OrthoBerry is structured, that we want to make sure that the patients are actually getting a really nice kind of match with their day-to-day life mm-hmm. forms to just like even enter their, you know, new patient, you know, medical history, all of those. And then we're also working on a very different ways to present their treatment plan to them. And it would be more like, okay, this is your case. These are the cases that we have. And this is what we suggest. And again, that's very well polished in terms of the structure that we presented to the patient. Because mm-hmm. I feel like majority of practice managements that I see, at least in the US, but maybe a little bit outside, they're built for the practitioner mm-hmm. and they're sure. great. They're great in what they're doing. I mean, majority of them are also, the framework of those softwares are so old and the UX UI is very brutally to manage. Mm-hmm. So we want to flip it again. Like, you know, when we talk about this, you know, when I got connected to the co-founders and became kind of like, you know, kind of more involved in this project, we want to flip everything and start from the patient. Mm-hmm. And from the patient, we work backward to the practice. And then we'll have, you know, the payment stuff is all dialed down. We have a very, really good task management software that is built inside this, the kind of suite of all these products. It's an ambitious project. It's going to take a while. We're working on little pods, and ultimately these pods are going to get compressed to create that, like, kind of bigger mm-hmm. platform. Mm-hmm. So then obviously the AI is a bigger component in every single one of mm-hmm. these. But first we need to build it, then we can put AI on top of it.
Great. Sounds very exciting. Cool. So I want to lastly wrap up with the question that I want to really get your input on. So what do you think about the future of aligners, how it's going to shape up? And also, there are going to be a lot of steps along the way, maybe in getting there, but how do you think education, maybe AI, is going to be involved in getting there?
Sure. I think, you know, when you look at the AI and, you know, because of my exposure to ULAB, we've improved so much. The procedures that you takes long time to make those, they're getting easier. The algorithm to move the teeth is going to get easier. I think collectively, the appliance is going to get better, more efficient, smarter. And I also think that there are some, you know, kind of activities in the fixed appliances part. And there's also the patient fatigue that they're like, I just don't want aligners. Mm-hmm. They just want fixed appliances. They're mm-hmm. kids that they like braces. I think the way that I look at it, it will be the winner or the people that they're going to be like ahead of everybody else, where they learn how to combine plastic and wire together. Like ideally, you want to have one platform that does it. Nothing is out there that does these very smoothly. I think the closest one to them is SureSmile that has a custom wire and a plastic. There's some other companies that they do IDB and stuff, but they're not streamlined. Even SureSmile is not very streamlined. But I think when we get to the point that is so easy for me to, I joke about it, like go to my drawer and pull out 20 sets of aligners and then also have my wire. So the day that we can do these transitions so much easier, that's going to be the best day for the patients, because they don't need to be in fixed appliances for a long time. They don't need to be in aligner for a long time. Both of them, that they have their own challenges, right? There is no doubt that the aligner systems are going to get better. The appliances are going to get better. We will become better with plastic or maybe 3D printed stuff. So I don't envision it as one or the other. I actually envision it as something completely new that marinate all of these inside that ecosystem or that appliance, right? Mm-hmm. That's how I look at it.
Mm-hmm. Also, from an education perspective, I believe that AI is going to maybe provide a lot of, you know, advancement there, because I dream about this AI-aided education platform where you would ask any question and get an answer right away. And the beauty of AI in that sense, I believe, is, as you said, many lectures that you attend to will be maybe invalid in 5 years, right? But also with the online platforms, the research, whatever you can, you know, put on top. So it's going to be maybe invalid in 5 years. But the beauty of AI is you keep training the system, right? You keep feeding data. So in an ongoing education model, AI could provide a sustainable education platform online that you can also get answers very quickly, right? That's also a factor, yeah, because you don't want to sit and watch a 1 hour lecture to get like a tiny bit of information. So I have one day that happens, but I believe...
Yeah, that's 100% true. Yeah, for sure. And the other part that AI can help you is that AI can also tell you a lot of things about you that you don't know it, right? If you're systematically doing something that you don't know, and imagine if you put that on top of your cases, and it will tell you all your diff 2 or your deep bite cases are finishing 24 months because you're missing this step. And that by itself, it has a huge educational value.
True.
That is kind of indirectly you learning from yourself. And I completely agree with you. I think that the courses, the classes are going to go away where like, this is my question, I want to have an answer, show me who thinks that, right? I mean, it's kind of the same as, I used to go to Google and search. I don't go to Google and search anymore. I'm always on Perplexity. Sure. And this is an AI that basically milk Google and all the other stuff and process it and give it to me.
Yeah.
Right or wrong, that's just an easier way to find things.
Sure, of course. Even now, I mean, if you ask ChatGPT questions related to dental operations, it provides a relatively good overview. I mean, you can, of course, try to get into more detail with other resources. But so guys, if you're not using it, start using it somehow. Implement AI in your practice. I highly encourage it. I'm sure Ruth highly encourages it.
For sure.
So anything you want to add before we wrap up?
No, I think it's just, it was great to chat with you. I'm excited to be on your podcast. Thank you so much for the invitation. And just push it forward and think forward, and everything is only better tomorrow, the way that everything is changing at this rate.
Yeah, I agree. Thank you, man. Thank you for
Of
being on the
course.
show. It was a great pleasure. I had a lot of fun. And also, people who are thinking about coming to the AAS meeting, I once again highly encourage you to come, even just to meet with Drews. I think you should be there. Pick his brain, get his thoughts on things. It's been great. Thank you so much, man.
For sure. Absolutely.
Take
Thanks a
care
lot.
and see you on the next one. Bye-bye.
See you later. Bye.